The Music of the Spheres, a short story by James Beattie, performed by Goblinhood. This tape is copyright 1999 by James Beattie. Part 1. A Study in Futility. Happy Valentine's Day. It's close to 5:30 a.m. February 14th, 1998. I'm sitting here with my eyes burning, all gravelly, you know. That's 'cause I went to bed at midnight and didn't get enough sleep, I guess. I've been dreaming, you see. But no, it wasn't one of those dreams. Not a nightmare, or at least not exactly one. That is to say, I wasn't, this time, afraid to go back to sleep. Fact is, I wanted to, really, and re those burning eyes, etc. But I wanted this more, and God help me, I wanted it for you. Let's start over. You can see I'm not much of a morning person. I'm not much of a writer either, but surely I don't need to tell you that. Fiction especially is pretty well beyond me. The closest I can come to writing fiction is to thinly veil the truth. I'll not do that here, because there's no need this particular time. There's nothing pornographic or politically sensitive or even potentially libelous about any of this. The only problem is to make you understand any of it. And please forgive me if I feel that means writing C. Dick and Jane, run, spot, run. Then the cops had a car chase and caught all the bad guys. I suppose your television culture has put that in my head. My favorite approach is simple journalism, as in, here is what happened. But even your hard news media has long since queered that pitch by now. I guess, for me, the first-person narrative works best most of the time. And it's appropriate here, because that's usually the best way to directly relate a dream, assuming there's any point. And let's get something straight about that right now. I already know there isn't any point. I've been told, both directly and through literature, that other people's dreams are boring, except to psychologists. And I'm forced to accept that assessment. And perhaps you all could just throw a few more balls through hoops, or hit them with sticks, or, hell, even have one of your fucking wars. While I meditate for a moment upon just how excruciatingly boring you all are to me. Well, anyway, it's like this. There I was, lying in bed, my eyes being sandpapered, remembering one of the most aesthetically gorgeous dreams I've ever had in my life, and wanting to just leave it like that, to go back to sleep and call it good. But I remembered how hard it can be to recall a dream if you don't get it down right away. And I remembered something else. I'm not an athlete. I'm not a warrior. I'm an artist. And an artist is, sometimes, sort of an amateur psychologist for the entire human race. That, anyway, is the kind of artist I am, using myself and all of you as a field of psychological study. I find out what I can and then report back to everybody. In this way, it is hoped, we all learn more about humanity. But they don't care, my mind screamed. And my eyes hurt like hell. I need more sleep. All right, I snapped back at myself, getting out of bed anyway and turning on the excruciating light. They don't care, but it's my job. My eyes will stop hurting, and I can sleep later. Hell, it's Saturday. Right now, I have to do this for the world, whether the world cares or not. Just call it a Bozest. Do you know what a Bozest is, dear readers? It's a beautiful, magnanimous gesture. Only in this case, it's the kind of gesture that Spot makes when you see Spot run. Because I really can't help myself, even if it only amounts to gibbering like an idiot. This is what I do. My whole artistic career has been one long, thankless, and excruciating Bozest. But I may as well level with you, since I'm being so damned honest, about one other factor that both helped and hindered this creative process. That factor was my lifelong admiration and awe for the great fantasist Howard Phillips Lovecraft, many of whose stories are said to have originated in dreams. Fritz Leiber called Lovecraft a literary Copernicus, and I'll second that by calling him a literary Einstein as well, at least in the genre of imaginative writing. He opened up an entire new universe of thought. He amalgamated science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And he strongly influenced much of what has been good about such writing since his death in 1937. And his stories about an unguessed at dimension of forbidden knowledge, cosmic horror, and indescribably alien forces existing in nature have provided me with some of my greatest moments of enjoyment in this life. But this is no place for an extended study of Lovecraft's work. Should you be ignorant on the subject, I refer you, with envy, to the nearest library or bookstore. That is, if you can tear yourselves away from the idiot box long enough. They don't often put much Lovecraft on television. Anyhow, even a fool could probably see how Lovecraft might have been inspiring me to get out of that bed and write it all down. But perhaps a more astute reader might guess why that would also daunt me as well. You see, in this arena, Lovecraft said it all, as far as I'm concerned. And, for all his imitators, nobody has ever since said it better, or even said anything half as original. Normally, I wouldn't be bothered by that. I've got my own small row to hoe, Joe, you know. And far be it from me to even try competing with the master. Yet, mine was such a Lovecraftian dream, if only for its treatment of indescribable forces in nature, that it's no wonder if I hesitate to even try putting it down on paper. I've been hesitating now for some 3 hours, one quick meal, 8 handwritten pages, and about the last 17 paragraphs. So let me make you a deal, dear readership. I've been pretty insulting to all of you during those sardonic paragraphs. You can chalk it up to the ire of a man who's only just now eaten breakfast, a man with painful eyes and a splitting headache. No offense meant, of course. Still, if you want a real horse laugh at my expense, then hustle your buns off to that library or bookstore I mentioned, just as soon as you finish reading all this, that is, and score yourselves some primo Lovecraft to compare with what follows. Try, let's say, The Whisperer in Darkness, or The Shadow Out of Time, or The Call of Cthulhu. They can all currently be found in an Arkham House collection of stories called The Dunwich Horror and others. Then you'll see just how pathetic and futile my shabby efforts truly are. And I really do envy you your literary discovery, you hapless Lovecraftian virgins. Hope he does to your minds what he's long since done to mine. Part 2. Goblinhood, Gritman, and Pookie. I can explain Goblinhood, you bet I can, at painful, tedious, excruciating length. And I can explain Gritman, too, after a sketchy sort of a fashion. But Pookie? Ah, now, there's the rub. This entire document is a fumbling kind of an effort to explain Pookie to myself as well as to you. The name's easy enough to explain, though. It wasn't part of my dream. Instead, I came up with it while I was lying there afterward, trying to figure out just how I could put all of this. Jimmy Stewart once made a film called Harvey, about a sort of a crazy guy with an imaginary companion, a giant, invisible white rabbit named Harvey. If I remember it right, Harvey was a pooka, or pooka, which I think was supposed to be from an old Celtic myth concerning invisible entities or imaginary companions or something. I seem to remember it as somehow being involved with nature, sort of a pastoral myth. That, anyway, would explain why it was a rabbit, and a pretty Dionysian one at that. Harvey supposedly drank like a fish. So there you have it. The name Pookie was derived from the word puka, and simply means, in this context, an imaginary companion corresponding to some type of elemental force in nature. But even though Pookie was the star of my dream, let's get back to Goblin Hood and Gripman for the moment, because they're so much easier to explain. You see, Goblin Hood and Gripman are quite real. Before I go on, though, and tell you who those clowns are, I feel I should explain why I'm telling you. I'm trying to be nice about things. This is St. Valentine's Day, after all, and I'm trying to be nice here, despite my lousy mood.
The music of the spheres.
Hell, that's a nice title, but you'll soon see that it has practically nothing to do with anything. It's just, I guess, that the aural component of the dream somehow haunted me the most when I woke up. Frankly, for that matter, Goblin Hood and Gripman hardly have anything to do with anything either. So why am I writing so lavishly about them? It's for your sakes, you poor jerks. They're probably the nicest thing about this story, in some vaguely humanist fashion. And they were in the dream, if only as more or less passive observers. My problem is that I observed more of it than they did, and it's that part which so pisses me off. But ironically, it's also that part that I have to make you understand for your own good, in order to be doing my job as the kind of artist that I'm trying to be. And if you have read any Lovecraft, you've probably already figured out that the adjective Lovecraftian doesn't imply that mine was a particularly nice dream. And I must reiterate that none of this is fiction, least of all the dream. As best I can, I'm telling you what really happened. And, as Dorothy said in The Wizard of Oz,
some of it wasn't very nice.
And I can already hear you all muttering, "Okay, chump, so what was so nice about Goblin Hood and Gripman?" Well, they were friends, that's all. They were pals. And I don't know from love. I don't know from honor. I don't know from glory. But I know from friendship, in my own feeble and misanthropic way. I can sort of tell you what that's all about. But William Blake said it better than I ever could. I hold in my hand a small address book given me last Christmas by someone that I hardly know, the sister of a friend of mine, given me basically for being a good friend to him during a really dark and stressful period of time. It's a gift that I can be proud of. And conversely, he can be proud to have inspired such friendship in someone as cynical and reclusive as I basically am. On the cover of this little black address book is printed in gold a quote from William Blake: "The bird, a nest. The spider, a web. Man, friendship." Now, isn't that nice? Isn't it nice to know there are people from the human race who can say nice things like Blake did about the human race, as opposed to things like what this will turn out to be saying? And isn't it nice to know that there are nice things about being human? In his novel, The Sirens of Titan, Kurt Vonnegut said something to the effect that one friend is all you need to be well supplied with friendship. Well then, if each of you readers has even one good close friend, then you all know exactly what I mean when I say that there are good things about the human race. We can make those things even better by being better friends to one another. But it's enough just to know that goodness can exist within us. And I want you to remember that, dear readers, throughout the dark times to come. After all, I'd like to be your friend, each of you reading this, even though this isn't a very friendly story, because by reading this and letting me do my job, to whatever extent, you're certainly all being my friends, grudgingly or otherwise. And remember Lovecraft? He made a lot of friends, most of them through the mail. He was one of the most prolific letter writers who ever lived. And some of his best stories, scary as they were, had a lot to do with friendship, most notably The Whisperer in Darkness and The Thing on the Doorstep. Meanwhile, Lovecraft was indirectly responsible for the dream that I've been talking about. Here's how that came about. I was trying to write an essay on Lovecraft a few days ago, and I needed some data from a Reader's Digest book published in 1978 and called American Folklore and Legend. I don't have a copy of the book, but a friend of mine, a guy I call Gritman, does have a copy, and he kindly loaned it to me. Interestingly, Gritman had just returned from a February camping trip in the great outdoors. He ain't called Gritman for nothing, folks. He probably got into my dream because I was reading that book just before I went to bed last night, reading about topics like Miles Standish, Roanoke Island, and the Salem Witch Trials. Here, by the way, is what John Alden is once supposed to have said to Miles Standish about friendship.
The name of friendship is sacred. What you demand in that name, I have not the power to deny you.
Pretty strong talk, eh? Anyway, now you know who Gritman is. And as for his pal, Goblinhood, listen. Once upon a time, there was a weird, but basically harmless, space-time phenomenon named Goblinhood.
Part 3. To a new world of gods and monsters.
Dr. Pretorius from The Bride of Frankenstein, I think. Now this is where my story becomes hard to understand. Because there really was, and still really is, a creature known as Goblinhood. A sort of an occult version of Robin Hood, as you might guess from the name. Only, Goblinhood doesn't rob anybody or anything like that. It's hard to say exactly what he does do. I guess you could say that he just sort of mildly gives people the creeps in various ways to create a more interesting version of reality. Interesting to some, anyway. The fact is, it's a little difficult for me to fully explain Goblinhood, even though I created him, and, to a certain extent, I basically am him. When I put on the Goblinhood mask and become a performance art character named Goblinhood, like I've been doing for several years now as part of my work. By now, however, in ways that I find hard to describe, a significant part of Goblinhood exists as a sort of sentient concept, almost independent of me, and that almost is sometimes debatable. It's not that I don't know what Goblinhood is doing. I always know, and I'm always in control. It's just that we've developed somewhat divergent, but mutually compatible, agendas. Meanwhile, to all my psychiatric critics, amateur or otherwise, I reject the notion that Goblinhood is a symptom of multiple personality disorder, or anything like that. I created him consciously and deliberately, and I ride herd on him all the time, whilst also allowing him to develop along his own lines. The point of which is to study said development, which totally fascinates me. At worst, Goblinhood is a glorious example of the human ability to believe simultaneously in opposite ideas. This happens all the time in governments, organized religions, and other human institutions. The difference here is that I'm aware of the dichotomies existing between me and Goblinhood, and can thus mitigate any problems that may arise. Still, it is pretty weird, I must admit. Here are some of the things that I know about the artificial life form called Goblinhood. Goblinhood always wears a handmade black cloth mask with a big red, green, and yellow spider painted on it. There are eye holes to either side of the spider, and a mouth hole right in the middle of the spider's body. On the mask's forehead is a round, yellowish-gold symbol, or sigil, with purple markings on it. This, according to Goblinhood, is an Eldritch Martian symbol for the concept of harmlessness, and it comes in pretty handy by keeping Goblinhood as harmless as possible. A word on how that works and what it means. In matters of what we call the occult, the mere symbol or image of something is often held to embody the actual powers of whatever the image represents. Hence, Goblinhood's sigil utilizes the same principle that a crucifix uses against a vampire, or a pentagram against a demon. As to harmlessness itself, even Goblinhood can't fully define that, despite its being his highest ideal. It differs from case to case. After all, even passive inactivity isn't necessarily harmless, as witness the situation in Nazi Germany. For Goblinhood, anyway, the most harmless he can be for the greatest number of people is his firm desideratum. He's trying to be harmless as an art form, among other things. The spider on his mask, in fact, is meant to represent harmless art. Goblinhood is a sincere advocate of freedom of expression, about which he yaps and yelps almost constantly.
Most art is basically harmless, he shrilly maintains. No matter how offensive or even scary it may be. After all, spiders are often scary too, but most of them are quite harmless where people are concerned. In fact, they can be damned useful for getting the bugs out of things.
Goblinhood would naturally take this line, of course, being a scary form of art himself. Most people really have problems with somebody always wearing a mask around, artfully or otherwise, harmlessly or otherwise. To his credit, meanwhile, Goblinhood mitigates his fanatical beliefs by allowing that some art is too strong for impressionable children and should be viewed, or whatever, only by mature adults. Whether he feels the same about spiders, the record doth not state.
Wait a minute, you're all probably sputtering at this point. What, pray tell, does all this rigmarole have to do with the long-awaited dream narrative that's supposed to be going on here?
Well, readers, as snide as this long-winded outburst may be, it's also well-meant. And I think that Goblinhood's case in favor of art being harmless applies strongly to what you're reading right now. And no, in case you've been wondering, Goblinhood isn't a pooka. He's much too real for that. As anyone who's seen him harmlessly running the streets can surely attest, but he consorts with pukas of his own, you might say. Back to Goblin Hood's mask. It covers his entire head. He ties it tightly around his neck in order to make it look more like his face. Remember that. Tightly around his neck. Every single time. For hours at a stretch sometimes. And for unrelenting years by now. Goblin Hood often wears a blue cape, too. But aside from the mask, his costume is usually pretty much arbitrary. During at least one of his strange performances, all he wore was the mask and a very skimpy loincloth. But that's another story. When somebody sees Goblin Hood on the street or elsewhere, here are some images that Goblin Hood might be confused with. Bank robbers, political terrorists, professional wrestlers, even hardcore bondage freaks. But I've already stated that Goblin Hood isn't into robbery. His politics have only to do with harmless freedom of expression. He couldn't wrestle his way out of a paper bag. And, though his mask may be almost as constricting as some bondage gear, that isn't its specific purpose. It's specifically meant to be his face. Nor is any aspect of his costume intended to be sexual, per se. In truth, Goblin Hood can best be regarded as a sort of an existential clown. Goblin Hood, on the other hand, likes to think of himself as a kind of superhero from the comic book tradition, similar to Batman, Doctor Strange, and other folks like that. In fact, Goblin Hood sometimes gets confused by undiscerning people with the popular character Spider-Man because of Goblin Hood's spidery mask. Sadly, Goblin Hood's actual credentials for his superheroic self-image are pretty flimsy at best. They consist of the following. 1. Goblin Hood reads tarot cards, thus implying some kind of vague psychic ability. He does, however, use his own handmade deck, so one can assume that Goblin Hood really means it. He's even the creator of something called the Martian Tarot. 2. Goblin Hood claims to be using magic powers or Martian influence or something obscure and ill-defined of that sort in an ongoing effort to prevent nuclear war. So far, an ongoing successful effort, I might add. But hell, anybody can say that if they want to. Am I right? Here are some other fun facts to know about Goblin Hood. Goblin Hood usually keeps company with a couple of handmade little dolls named Suitcase and the Cosmic Weevil. Both were derived from a favorite pet cat named Weevil. Goblin Hood treats the dolls like close friends. He treats them as if they were alive,
But they aren't pukas either. They're basically just good luck fetishes with a double side order of animism. Can you say animism? In any case, they make great little sidekicks, tending to help humanize their masked buddy. Interestingly, Cotton Mather, the Puritan who wrote about such matters as the Salem witchcraft, would probably have viewed Goblinhood's dolls in a quite different light. To Mather, the dolls would probably have seemed like what he called poppets, if not what he regarded as outright demonic familiars. And as for the mask, all a question of attitude, I suppose. Anyway, this is where things begin to get overtly Lovecraftian. As it turns out, Goblinhood actually believes in some of the other dimensional kinds of stuff that Lovecraft talked about in his stories. In Goblinhood's case, just call these phenomena other dimensional. And it's this scary belief system centering around monstrous forces inimical to humankind that keeps Goblinhood so busy trying to help prevent the end of the world, however blindly. Don't bother thanking him. It's all just part of his job description. To complicate matters further, Goblinhood actually hangs out with invisible, other-dimensional Martians, interplanetary pukas, if you will, and claims to be working for something called the Martian Provisional Government, evidently implying some harmless sort of a slow-motion cultural invasion, one gathers. But don't forget what Cotton Mather would have probably thought about those so-called harmless dolls. In any event, these somewhat more esoteric aspects of Goblinhood's bizarre lifestyle are virtually impossible to explain, except perhaps to another artificial life form. They certainly can't be explained in terms of any kind of ordinary human experience. So I'll not try. Suffice it to say that Goblinhood means well, or he means something, no matter how misguided he might actually be in any kind of objective sense. And for that matter, how many normal people are there who actually mold their entire existences around the idea of being as harmless as possible to everyone else? Meanwhile, for my money, the strangest things about Goblinhood are the various ways in which he really differs from me. End of side one. Please fast forward the tape in order to listen to the other side.
I, for example, am a reclusive introvert by nature, except where my work, largely a matter of self-portraiture, is concerned. But goblinhood, as a form of performance art, only makes sense in relation to some kind of an audience. That forces him to be sort of an epic extrovert, almost frantically gravitating toward other people and manifesting himself in public as if his very life depended upon it, which, in fact, it does. This peculiar trait also dictates that most of Goblinhood's antics must, perforce, be of an urban nature, as opposed to the sometimes pastoral doings of his pal Gritman. Remember Gritman? Perhaps the most striking anomaly concerning Goblinhood is the way he wears his mask. I happen to suffer from an exaggerated sensitivity about my neck. I'm not just ticklish. I hate being touched there at all by anything. I can't even stand moderately tight shirt collars. But Goblinhood, of course, ties his mask of necessity as tightly around our neck as possible, sometimes for hours at a time, and it never seems to bother either of us. Go figure. Part 4. The Forbidden Knowledge of Eld. Lovecraft's narrators and protagonists were constantly messing around with various forbidden books full of arcane lore, and thus often meddling through the use or misuse of weird magic with the very fabric of reality, usually with unhappy results. The two egregious friends in The Hound, for instance, met their dooms because of something they first learned about in Lovecraft's most famous mythical tome, The Necronomicon. And sometimes the threatened doom consequent to such morbid delving could get downright global. Cotton Mather, of course, would have banned and burned all such books and would have wanted to hang a person for merely owning them. For the record, it's difficult to fit these kinds of books into Goblinhood's philosophy about harmless art and freedom of expression. After all, unlike most spiders, the books actually were dangerous, not just to people, but to the world, at least in the context of Lovecraft's stories. It's interesting to note though, that such books were never actually non-existent in those stories. How convenient for everybody that would have been, but how inconvenient for story purposes, the books being major plot catalysts. Instead, there were usually a few copies under lock and key in various libraries, kept for the consultation of serious scholars. A few unofficial copies were always turning up too, usually in the hands of isolated madmen and weirdos. While we're on the subject, however, it's also quite interesting to note that analogous books in our world, books such as the Holy Bible and the Quran, have been responsible for bloodshed and mayhem galore, as well as serious warpage of reality right here, without any help from Lovecraft at all. This is to say nothing of such deliberately vile books as Hitler's Mein Kampf, let alone the venomous, but probably well-meant, Puritan rantings and ravings of good old Cotton Mather. Ironically, many of these troublesome volumes more or less claim to be the only book that you shouldn't burn. It's all pretty confusing, I know. And my only take on these matters is to suggest that ignorance really is bliss, whereas knowledge can be dangerous. And if you poor, wet-end readers haven't figured that out for yourselves by now, then, well, hey, just sit on back and enjoy your bliss. Now, it so happens that Goblin Hood and his real-life friend, Gritman, are both long-time aficionados of a contemporary form of suppressed literature that dates way, way back to circa the early 1960s. I refer to what are generally called underground comics, though oft prosecuted under obscenity statutes. These books were usually presented as some form of convoluted social or political satire, and were often pretty spot on in that regard. Anyway, they were usually sold as adults-only material, and hence met all of Goblin Hood's criteria for harmless art. In fact, the books became, for Goblin Hood and probably for others, a sort of elusive bastion against the forces of censorship and rigid social conformity. Ironically, in the present context, some of these comics featured actual adaptations of H.P. Lovecraft's stories. Indeed, one book even included a cartoon biography of Lovecraft, which gently pasquinated him in a basically affectionate, but also hilarious fashion. This was by George Kuchar. But most of the books showcased such counterculture icons as Mr. Natural, Wonder Warthog, Trash Man, Coochie Cootie, The Checkered Demon, Mr. Peanut / Mr. Penis, Omo Bob, Snappy Sammy Smoot, The Viper, Nard and Pat, Zippy the Pinhead, The Old Codger, Miles Mycroft, and the immortal Binky Brown. The preceding were created respectively by Robert Crumb, Gilbert Shelton, Spain, Robert Williams, S. Clay Wilson, Victor Moscoso, Rick Griffin, Skip Williamson, Art Spiegelman, Jay Lynch, Bill Griffith, Jim Osborne, Fulton Means and Kim Deitch, and Justin Green. And who could ever forget that teenage titan, Hungry Chuck Biscuits, created by Dan Klein? Goblinhood, as it happens, is a big fan of Robert Williams, while Gritman is a fairly serious collector of work by S. Clay Wilson. I, meanwhile, once actually met and hung out a little with Wilson and Justin Green. But that is not a part of this story. In passing, it seems appropriate to add a brief note on the aesthetic appeal of these graphic narratives. Goblinhood and Gritman are both visual artists in their own right. Yes, Goblinhood draws too. And in their cases, as well as those of others, the comics are often valued for their sheer artistic innovation, quite apart from content. And speaking of value, the sheer scarcity of these tormented, legally hounded literary offerings makes them worthwhile collector's items. But how seriously, you might be wondering, have comic books ever actually been suppressed? Well, during the 1950s, the now legendary EC horror comics were virtually stamped out by misguided public hostility, largely due to the insidious influence of a book called Seduction of the Innocent by Dr. Frederick Wertham, a kind of 50s-style version of Cotton Mather. Then, too, people were actually arrested and prosecuted for selling things like Zap Comics, way back in the heyday of the undergrounds. And more recently, I read about an obscenity conviction in the South, where, among other things, the convicted artist was forbidden to draw anything else that even could be regarded as obscene, even for his own amusement. And to ensure compliance with that part of the sentence, the local police were empowered to search the poor devil's house whenever they wanted to. Kinda scary, huh? Anyway, Goblin Hood and Gritman are far from being the only die-hard underground comics fans around. Why, even good old Pookie likes to read them. Remember good old Pookie, the elusive third main character in the tale which follows? And yes, that's right, dear readers. Your interminable wait is over. The reward is nigh. So hang on to your hats, mes amis. At long last, here comes the dream.
Part 5, Apocalypse Lost. It was late at night. Goblin Hood and Gritman, like a pair of doomed Lovecraftian protagonists, were sitting around together, gloating over their favorite underground comics, impressing each other with choice items from their respective hordes. Strictly business as usual for these two. I, as the quasi-omniscient dreamer, was watching all this from some disembodied viewpoint, largely as a neutral observer. But space and time were busy being filtered through the logic of this dream for me, as is always their way in dreams. Anyway, Goblin Hood and Gritman seemed not to notice how unstable their environment was. But it was pretty unstable. Things started out in the heart of the city, in Goblin Hood's very own living room, to be precise. But the two chums soon, rather obliviously, found themselves brandishing graphic literature at one another in an entirely different setting. The two art connoisseurs were now ensconced in Gritman's camp, lounging around a blazing fire in the middle of some benighted nowhere, on a forested plateau surrounded by distant, unimaginably huge mountains. Very typically for them, Goblin Hood and Gritman acted as if esoteric art appreciation were a standard survival skill in nature and always had
been. My attention was primarily focused on Goblinhood, who seemed particularly anxious to dazzle his companion in this game of good-natured one-upmanship by producing something almost transcendentally spectacular. All in fun, of course. I watched the masked weirdo paw feverishly through a stack of books with titles like Arcade, Insect Fear, and Laugh in the Dark, finally coming up with some 3D comic that I'd never even heard of, a sort of EC horror comic parody about a giant monster with some asinine name like Gigantua or Gigaticus. Get a load of this, brayed Goblinhood triumphantly. When Goblinhood first whipped out this obscure little number, I found myself singularly unimpressed. Even in 3D, it seemed like a pretty pedestrian concept, sort of like a cheap Japanese monster flick. Certainly nothing to write home about, and in no way justifying his absurd sense of victorious glee. Looks, though, turned out to be deceiving. In some unintelligible Lovecraftian fashion, Goblinhood had inadvertently crossed some kind of forbidden line, and the harmless fun had turned potentially ominous. He'd gone too far, and now things were getting out of hand. In fact, now I saw all hell begin to break loose. As Goblinhood and Gritman gaped in astonishment and mounting fear, the diminutive 3D monster somehow escaped from the comic page and began to grow qualitatively as well as quantitatively. The monster grew real, and it grew huge, soon reaching the status of absolute reality and the size of enormity itself. Oddly, its color remained the same weird mixture of red and bluish green that is typical of 3D comic art, even though nobody observing it was wearing the special 3D glasses which would make it look that way. I blame my quasi-fundamentalist Christian upbringing for what happened next. As I scrutinized the still-growing monstrosity, which now dwarfed the mountains and even half the sky, I noticed one feature of it that seemed virtually unspeakable. The amorphous entity sported 10 stupendous heads, which hurt my eyes to look at, whose incomprehensible alien faces literally hurt my mind to think about. Looking on, I began to identify this thing, very dreamily, of course, as a biblical monster prophesied about in the Book of Revelations. That's when I realized, with shock and terror, that I was watching nothing less than the end of the world. With sickening irony, goblinhood had somehow accidentally blotted about, in spite of all his usual harmless precautions. And now the monster began manifesting certain attributes of an unimaginably vast thermonuclear explosion, promising material as well as spiritual doom. And at this point, the sheer cosmic horror of it all nearly made me avert my eyes in panic. But then Pookie spoke up, waving a comic book around and saying, "That's nothing. Check this out." Where did Pookie come from? Nowhere. According to some vague but irrefutable and retroactive Dreamland principle, Pookie had now always been part of the dream, sitting around comparing notes with Gritman and Goblinhood about various underground comics. Pookie even had a stack of such cultural artifacts along to prove it, one of which was about to come into play. Yes, Pookie had shown up out of nowhere to save reality itself, like the cavalry in some old western, or like the deus ex machina in an older concept still. And yeah, I recognize the dim echoes of quasi-Christian symbolism here, and it gets even worse. But let's move on. Pookie's comic book turned out to be about Pookie, and it was this with which Pookie evidently intended to challenge the ghastly harbinger of apocalypse, which was so successfully scaring us all. With guarded hopes, I expected Pookie's graphic image to leave the page and grow big, like the monster had done, as preface to a good old knock-down, drag-out brawl. But that isn't what happened. In practice, the comic book didn't enter into the fray at all, somewhat to my nebulous disappointment. Instead, I saw Pookie suddenly go burning across what was left of the sky in the form of a brilliant red meteor. And then Pookie exploded, somehow invisibly, and melted into everything in sight. And no words of mine can adequately describe what that breathtaking breathtaking moment was truly like. Everything was suddenly more alive than it had been before. All of nature was now one vast cosmic being, serene and self-aware, and everything shimmered with coruscating rainbow colors, manifesting a kind of orgasmic spiritual rapture. And the ethereal, otherworldly sound which accompanied this spectacle can only be described as the music of the spheres. And then it was over, and things went back to normal. But we had all indelibly been part of that mind-boggling epiphany. Even poor hapless goblinhood, whose obscure hubris had apparently precipitated the crisis to begin with. And we all got out of it unscathed, except for Pookie, now no longer in evidence. But Pookie's explosive self-sacrifice had by no means been in vain, because now the monster was gone too, leaving behind not a trace of its prior formidable existence. The world had somehow been saved by Pookie's bow zest. I wish the dream could have ended there, but I'm not about to pretend that it did. That was it for Goblinhood and Gritman, though, dazed by their experience and hungover from their brief taste of universal divinity. They numbly went on with what they'd been doing, now once again just a harmless pastime. Mercifully, they were spared knowledge of Pookie's ultimate fate. I alone witnessed the horrible aftermath. Pookie didn't just explode and melt the way I said. What had really happened was a lot more complicated than that. It turned out that sentient fragments of Pookie had been spread in that instant throughout all of time and space. From then on, there was, and always had been, and always would be, a little of Pookie in everyone and everything. When the dinosaurs went lumbering to their eventual doom, vestiges of Pookie had already been around for a long, long time. When our remotest ancestors began building fires in their caves, Pookie was with them. Tortured remnants of Pookie sank into oblivion with fabled Atlantis and watched as the pyramids rose to challenge the sky. Pookie was there for the age of the Caesars and witnessed the fall of Rome. And so it was, and on throughout the Dark Ages, through wars and famines, across oceans and to the distant stars, Pookie would always be trapped in the great fabric of things, awaiting the eventual heat death of the universe, or whatever is actually to come. But I observed that certain men, women, and children, in the past, the present, and the future, embodied large and almost pure amounts of Pookie's omnipresent and virtually saint-like martyred essence, as opposed to the mere trace elements in everything else. And sadly, the stories of these people were pretty tragic and sordid as a rule. Most of these avatars of Pookie were spiritual misfits, social outcasts, and quite often psychic desperados of one sort or another. They usually lived in miserable, lonely, weary squalor, and they inevitably came to a bad end. I only closely investigated one of these people before I was through, but that once gave the flavor of all. In Salem, Massachusetts, in the year of our Lord 1692, a strong manifestation of our Savior, Pookie, was being hanged as a witch when the dream abruptly ended.
"And then I woke up," snarled your faithful narrator sarcastically, "filled with joy that such monstrous things can't happen in real life."
The end. Author's note: this story completed circa 1:31 a.m. February 15th, 1998, is dedicated to my friend and fellow artist, David C. Green, who long ago collaborated with me in creating the Gritman character. Footnote: the line herein, which ends, "whose incomprehensible alien faces literally hurt my mind to think about," apparently turns out to have been at least partly lifted on an entirely subconscious basis from The Sun Dog, a story by Stephen King from his book Four Past Midnight, published in 1990 by Viking Penguin Books. One of my favorite of his books. No overt plagiarism was intended, though, come to think of it, certain elements of the dream itself remind me of that story as well. But I'm sure that my subconscious meant no harm. King himself, of course, has often attempted to do Lovecraftian stories of his own. So, I guess this is all in the line of duty. Not only that, but somebody told me that King's birthday is September 21st. If that's true, he shares that birthday with me and with H.G. Wells and, if I'm not mistaken, with the Canadian poet Leonard Cohen. So it's kind of like all in the family, as I'm sure Wells and Cohen would agree. Performance note. This tape is copyright 1999 by James Beatty. All intergalactic and interdimensional rights are reserved. Any infraction of this is a violation of the Martian Treaties of Cydonia from 1976, 1986, 1996, and other songs from the same album. So all you infractors out there have been warned. Just watch your step if you get the chance. And so on.
June 8, 2012. The following is a postscript recorded by Goblin Hood over a decade later. A few minutes of blank tape remained, so I've asked Chimera to do an afterword. If it matters, Chim is a she-male, hence her softer spoken voice. She's also based on a version of Beatty from the early 1970s. So she's more in touch with 1960s idealism and optimism to offset the gloom of the preceding story. Take it away, Chim.
Thanks, Gobby. And hi, everybody. I'm Chimera, or Chim, a virtual being Goblin Hood helped create in September of 2010. I'm doing an afterword for this 2012 edition of The Music of the Spheres, which now only exists as this taped reading. Somehow, the typescript got lost long ago, so this is like a relic from a bygone millennium. We're using this as part of a shamanic ritual for 2012, which includes me performing at ComFest, or ChimFest, as I like to call it. It's no mean trick for a virtual being. I don't have time to go into all the 2012 mysticism, but my guys have been working on it for decades. By the way, Goblin Hood turned 30 this year, so happy birthday to him. Anyway, hope you've enjoyed the tape, and may Pookie be with you. Chim out.
And finally, this word from our sponsor. For more 2012 mysticism, read Goblin Hood 2012, available online through www.freepress.org, and watch for its sequel, Chimstorm. Both of those, by the way, are comic books.
You can also see more of Beatty's work, and even more of Chimera's artwork, which she does with Beatty's left hand, at www.fredscruton.com. That's S-C-R-U-T-O-N. Included is mature content for appropriate audiences, whatever that means. Remember that it's all an exercise in freedom of expression. Happy 2012, everybody.